From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in McDowell County, West Virginia, where a volunteer medical team brought free health care to residents. The initiative was led by West Virginia's public health commissioner at the time, Dr. Rahul Gupta. Now, the goal of Dr. Gupta and his team was to stop preventable deaths, to be specific, to prevent overdoses from opioid addiction. Drug overdoses are the leading cause of death for people under the age of 50 in the United States. And as Dr. Gupta has said, the opioid epidemic is the equivalent of a Boeing 737 crashing every single day in this country. Gupta was particularly challenged in his work in West Virginia because that is the state that has the highest rate of overdose deaths in the United States. During his visit to McDowell County, which was documented by the PBS program Nova, he met with men and women who struggle with addiction to discuss preventative efforts and to give them naloxone, an overdose reversal drug. He encouraged his patients to take the drug when needed and afterwards to get the help they need. His analysis of harm reduction initiatives like these revealed that every dollar spent on harm reduction saves up to $7 in medical costs down the line and steers more people toward treatment. Dr. Gupta has since left West Virginia and is now the Senior Vice President and Chief Medical and Health Officer for the March of Dimes. But his dedication to combating the opioid crisis has not wavered, and he's in Rochester this week to discuss the crisis at an upcoming event at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. But first, right here in our studio, he's our guest on Connections. And Dr. Gupta, thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I'm well, then. Thank you for having me today, Evan. Really appreciate the spotlight on this very important issue that is crippling both the human health as well as the economy of our country, certainly of our communities.
I was mentioning, Dr. Gupta, my first job out of college was in West Virginia for about a couple of years, not far from where you lived in the state capital of Charleston for what better part of a decade. Is that right?
That's right. And that's I've seen a lot of evolution happen all the way from what we call the diseases of despair and hopelessness, whether it's meth, whether it's opioids, whether it's street drugs, whether it's mental health and people struggling to find those common grounds as well as help for their health ailments. It is really the challenge of the 21st century in so many ways.
Well, also with us in studio is Yana Kashper, who is a co-founder of Rockcovery Fitness, living in recovery, and is one of the places mentioned with some frequency on this program as a place where people in recovery can go. They can find solidarity. How are things going at Rockcovery?
Things are going really well, really well. We can't even believe our growth, and it's been such a gift.
Well, there's a lot to talk about with Yana as well this hour. And Susan Verrett Allen is co-president of the Rochester Museum and Science Center Council. First of all, welcome to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Tell us what is happening tomorrow.
So tomorrow we are hosting our Dine and Discover event, which is a science-based educational public service announcement for the museum that the RMSE Council has created last year. And we want to give back to our community. And this was last fall I watched this documentary, and it was, I watched it with unabated focus. I learned so much, and I just felt that Dr. Gupta's message needed to come here. So tomorrow it's at noon, and we'll have a panelist of local decision makers and people like Yana that are making some positive changes in the community, and then Narcan training.
A lot of good things happening tomorrow. If you want to attend, you can still do that?
Yes, you can.
How do you do that?
You either call the museum directly or go on to rmse.org and purchase your tickets online.
Okay. And briefly, Susan, you mentioned what that PBS Nova program did for your understanding. Why do you think it was so effective for you? Because there's been news coverage, there's talk in our communities. Why was this program in particular so effective for you?
So at the time in last fall when I watched the film, I had known about opioid addiction. I never really comprehended what it was. And the message from this documentary that was so perfectly laid out explained to me the physiological, scientific reaction that our body experiences from the addiction, from the opioid. Mm-hmm. And it opened my mind, and it changed my entire view. And since then, so much has been in the news.
Well, tomorrow is a chance, as Susan says, bringing together a lot of the decision makers, people in this community, but also just kind of get the kind of training that you might need to better understand what happens it's real. It's touching so many families. And West Virginia, Dr. Gupta, is, of course, the state with the statistics that are the most grim on this. But I want to start by asking you first and foremost, and I don't mean this sort of flippantly, but is anything really working in this fight?
You know, I will start by saying that the way to find out and really address this crisis, and I call this a disaster or a crisis because to elevate the urgency of the need to get evidence-based both treatments, programs, and policies to work, is really to get a better understanding of why this is happening, how this really began, and then craft a treatment and programs that actually address the problem, because it's a huge problem. But to directly answer your question, I would say yes, there's a lot of things that are happening that are good in nature, that are driven by evidence science. There are also a lot of things happening that have no basis in science that are also, that you could say that they're happening, but do we know if it's working? We probably don't. Is there a more need for work to happen as well as for resources? I think there certainly is. I think we're not putting even a drop in the bucket when you compare. Even the White House did an analysis of this, the Council of Economic Advisors, and found that in 2015 dollars, the annual lost is about $504 billion. That's about $500 billion in 2015 dollars that we're losing as a nation each year in terms of health, human life, as well as productivity.
I was going to say journalist, but there's an author who I'm going to try to get on this program coming up here. He has a new book out called Dignity. His name is Chris Arnotti, and he's traveled the country, for days, worked for 2 years on this, going to the towns, sort of the manufacturing centers that have been hollowed out, the Ohio's, the rural New York, West Virginia, every state in the country. And his book is all about the way that we tend to forget a kind of segment of the population that we don't want to think about. You know, the people who that we might think, well, they're out of job, they're on drugs, they're down on their luck, and it's easier for me to kind of just put my hands over my eyes and not think about it. The book is called Dignity, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Chris about that, because one of the things that he repeatedly says in his journalism is that he does not think we're necessarily going to get past this if we don't have an economic sort of fix in this. And that doesn't mean there's an economic fix to the personal battles of addiction, but there's a lot of people who in West Virginia or in rural New York or in Ohio can't find work, grew up in towns that used to have factories that don't, and they're feeling a little lost. You're nodding over there.
Evan, I think that's, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, often people say a well-paying job solves a lot of problems. Now, here's the fact of life. When you are in, let's say you're a coal miner or you work on a steel factory or a timber industry or someplace, what you really used to do is not just for yourself, but provide and put food on the table for your family, have that dignity, have a community, have a church group, have a respect in that community, and have those linkages. Now, when that job is lost, it's really like pulling the carpet underneath from your living room. Everything just gets destroyed. The disconnections that happen, the hopelessness and despair that happens for you, and when it starts to happen for others in that community, really what you have is a community in shambles, and we have so many of those today. Giving people a carpet back isn't solving the problem. What we need to be able to do is start to rebuild those communities, and economic development is at the core. But there are other components, too, that includes addressing mental health, addressing good way of living, and really addressing what are those tools of the new century that's going to take for us to be able to. We're very good at addressing disease from a communicable disease standpoint. We're not very good at addressing societal issues that happen that result in those bad outcomes.
Yeah, and so, Yana, I want to turn to you because, you know, you with Recovery Fitness, you've met a lot of people in our community who need support, who are dealing with addiction, who are living in recovery, who want to be living in recovery, who might relapse, and seek to, again, still gain that kind of strength. And I don't want to overgeneralize because everyone's story is different. But are there any common threads that you see, especially when it comes to opioids? Is there any kind of a common thread?
Yeah, to kind of piggyback of what Dr. Gupta was saying, I believe that addiction is a disease of disconnection. Disconnection from community, from family, friends, and mostly from yourself. And we're seeing that quite a bit. It's isolation. It's feeling hopeless. It's not knowing where to turn. And where Recovery Fitness comes in is we provide those connections. We encourage growth. We support one another, and we really support reintegration into society with family and friends and just rebuilding lives.
You create community.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone suffering from addiction for various reasons might feel a loss of sort of grounded strength of support around them. A lot of people sort of feel alone in those situations.
Yeah, and especially kind of the way the thought process is when you're in active addiction, you know, morals, values, things of that sort go out the window, and you become driven by your disease as opposed to driven by the things that matter to you. And there's so much shame and guilt associated with addiction and societal stigma around addiction, where we really focus on acceptance and bringing those people back and having awareness around the disease of addiction and kind of the ways in which it changes our behaviors and the way we operate.
So I think what Yana and Recovery are doing are vital in any community that wants to create more of a sense of community and a foundation of support. But on the policy level, Dr. Gupta, are there things that are either being done or not done on the federal level and on state levels that you think, you know, are we missing opportunities on the policy level with this?
Yeah, so I'll even use an example. Last year, what happened was, as a commissioner in the state of West Virginia, I really got tired of seeing rises in deaths year after year. So we said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to start looking at why are these people dying. So we conducted what we call social autopsy. We went back just like a CSI style, and we turned over every corner we could for every death that happened in 2016 from overdose. We looked at people's lives for the last year. Were they incarcerated? Did they have insurance? Did they get naloxone at the time of their death? Were they married? Were they educated? Were they separated? Did they have a job? All those questions. And we found out that there were some things that we can do from a policy level. So we went out and got a couple of laws passed. So speak about policy. One of the problems is we're still, you know, we're on one hand having trouble addressing genuine, legitimate, credible pain for people. On the other hand, we are still prescribing too many opioids. And these two things are not contradictory to each other. On the other hand, we have still not put enough resources in ensuring that everyone who needs the help from a treatment standpoint gets evidence-based, data-driven, best treatments modernized when they need it and where they need it. Lastly, I think in the big picture, we have not invested as a nation in both prevention as well as what happens to somebody. When right now, every overdose is a cry for help. And people keep crying for help until they die. And then when they are dying, we do not have enough naloxone or Narcan, which is the antidote. And when we do give the antidote, we don't help those people get into treatment on a consistent and adequate level. These are all the areas that we could do better.
Before I get to your phone calls, Keith, I'll start with you in a moment. Stay there, and I'll let our listeners know. If you want to call the program as we talk opioids, we talk addiction, recovery, and the work that is ahead, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. If you're more comfortable, you can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is running for president, and she announced bipartisan legislation earlier this year. In fact, it was just a few months ago, to combat opioid addiction by limiting prescriptions to 7 days, basically saying that if you truly need opioids, we got to keep it at 7 days or less. From my first read from the medical community, it was not embraced very widely by the medical community, even though some of the sentiment was in the right place. Where are you on that?
Yeah, so in West Virginia, we enacted a law that said for opioid-naive people, meaning if you have a kid who's 18-year-old and gets a football ankle sprain, none of us want to see that child turn into someone who suffers from opioid addiction. So what we did, we enacted a law that said for all prescribers, includes dentists, veterinarians, you're not going to give initially more than 4 days of prescription. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, because the evidence shows after 3 to 5 days of prescribing, you're very much higher likelihood of getting in trouble with addiction. So I think that's a good, and remember, if we're doing and making policy that everybody gets on board with everything, then we're really not making policy. We're working on the edges to have consensus. This is a crisis. I just want to repeat, Evan, as you started today's discussion, we have 190-plus people dying every single day in this country. This should be taken and acted upon as an urgent crisis.
Okay, so it sounds like you think that there's some merit to this proposal, at least, in some ways creating... It doesn't also, to me, though, sound like it can be a blanket statement that nobody could get more than 7 days. Because I know there are people out there listening right now who go, if you take away opioids from my life, I don't know if I could handle the pain. So how do we balance that?
This is not about people who have chronic pain and then are on therapy. They need to continue that, and their physician needs to make the best decision about it. But for new people who are, we need to think about all the non-pharmaceutical as well as pharmaceutical alternatives to opioids.
Okay. And just, Jana, from your perspective as someone who, again, working in the recovery community, do you support the kind of restrictions on the length of time that people could get prescriptions for something like this? Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me. You know, I think it's a American drug crisis. You know, we don't see this in other parts of the world, in other countries, because we overprescribe at a rate that far exceeds any other place. I know I had a medical emergency that brought me to the emergency room, and the first line of defense was, you know, it was this pain scale and morphine right away. And there was no conversation about my history. We didn't talk about whether or not I had substance use disorder. And that was really scary, you know, for someone that may be earlier on or not as strong in their recovery. That's where recurrence to use can really happen. Hmm.
All right, Kevin, Keith, Katie on the phone. Let me get Kevin first on this exact subject. So go right ahead, Kevin.
Thanks for taking my call. First of all, in this day and age, in today's society, as modern as it is, I find it absolutely appalling that a prescribed drug is actually the cause of so many deaths, not to mention any other prescribed drug that has complications. And that we're actually discussing how to minimize how it's distributed instead of getting it off the market. There has to be better alternatives for pain management than something that equals death at the end that we can't control. Why is this still on the market? This wouldn't be acceptable in any other situation other than medical care. And this isn't medical care. This is a path to suicide or addiction that is well-known, established, and yet we're discussing how to keep it on the market and control it. It's obvious that it's about money, and it's not about the people and about real care. Take Eastern medicine, for example. I don't think they have this problem. This is a United States-driven money problem that's resulting in deaths, and we're discussing how to control it instead of getting rid of it. That's insane to me. I'll get your comments on the radio.
All right, Kevin, thank you. Strong views there, Dr. Gupta. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think Kevin highlights a lot of the thinking around this, but we've got to be very careful about there are millions and millions of Americans who right now need, on one hand, for their chronic pain, opioids. So we have to be conscious, not let the pendulum swing the other way, while knowing that the pendulum did get swung one way, and there was an organized, what we now understand, concerted effort to make sure that as many doctors prescribe as much opioids as possible. And this is something that I think we only need to look in the mirror to see who to blame. There's plenty of blame to go around, but it's very important to understand that we need to be judicious. I'm a big fan of FDA, for example, not approving any newer opioids unless there's a high threshold for approval.
But Kevin wants a ban on all opioids, it sounds like. Too far for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think primarily because we have not invested in R&D, research for alternatives, you know, until now. Now we're doing it. And we don't have alternatives, and we have tons of Americans who actually depend on these medications right now for their pain, good or bad. But we've got to have a transition plan to figure this out. But what we could do is, you know, we could turn this tap off. We could definitely stop new people who do not need to get into the substance, you know, addiction realm to get addiction.
All right, Keith, next on the phone. Go ahead, Keith.
I got a ton of questions here and comments. First of all, I've seen and I know of people who have responded to overdoses, heroin, in the morning, transport to the hospital, and then within 12 hours, they respond back to the same location for the same person that overdosed again. The problem we have is twofold. We have the medical prescribed opioids, which have become abusive, and then we have the illegal drugs bought on the street. Now, people can be a junkie and still function in society, just like you have functioning alcoholics. The problem being is when they buy it on the street and it's laced with something or they take too much of it, that the overdose occurs. So you remedy the fact of the overdose, but you don't stop the problem. So would it make sense to say, okay, if you're a junkie and you need your heroin fix, we're going to supply it to you in a medical setting. We're just going to give you enough to get you through, and that's it. You want it, you come back the next day. This way you can control it.
Yeah.
It's similar to what they're doing with marijuana.
Yeah.
The doctor had made a comment about this seems to be an American problem, the overall drug abuse. The reason why it's an American problem, we don't have a healthcare system in this country. We have a healthcare industry, and it's a big difference. And the other issue is it gets to the point where, and I'm as liberal as they come, but I lose compassion for somebody who has, you know, overdosed too much, too many times, look death in the eye, and somebody comes by with Narcan.
But why are you losing compassion?
Because they're doing it to themselves. I think what's more of a pressing healthcare issue is the attack now on women's health. I think that's appalling, and that's somebody else doing it rather than the people who overdosed. They got a bad batch that time, or they took too much, or the purity was off, or somebody laced it with fentanyl.
Yeah, well,
you got X amount of dollars. I would rather see it go towards women's health issues.
All right, so
then the.
I hear that you don't think that you would prioritize other things. Let me first, just to get this out of the way, ask Dr. Gupta, if we shifted priorities away from the opioid crisis, how much worse could it get?
Well, I could tell you that we've had, you know, plus 70,000 deaths in 2017 where you know, we could have more deaths. But I also want to comment about the issue of whose fault this is and are people really doing it to themselves. So I think this is part of our difficulty in dealing with this. It's a societal issue. It's a stigma issue. I try myself personally to stay away from the terms like a junkie or addict or other things because we don't call that when some, you know, when I see somebody coming in with a third heart attack in the hospital, they were eating burgers as a lifestyle. I don't say you've done it to yourself. Actually, we feel good about getting that person better and then giving them the same advice I've given them over the last 8 years and then sending them home and hoping that maybe this time they'll quit smoking because they're also doing it to themselves in that sense. But I think in this particular crisis, we think it's a disease of choice. Part of the understanding in addiction has to be that this is a chronic brain disease that continues to reoccur for some people. And when we look at this as a disease, then it's not something that they're choosing to do. If you look at the chemistry behind this thing, this is a actually chemical disease, a disorder that actually needs medications to help. Now, I will agree that there's a lot of fatigue in first responders because they have to go back. And sometimes I've seen five times ER see the same person in a day. So But the problem, you know what the problem there is? We didn't help them the first time. That's the problem. In the data that we did in West Virginia, we found that in the 1 year before their death, 4 out of 5 people came into contact with the healthcare system. We did not catch them. So we're, the healthcare system is partly to blame by not having the infrastructure to be able to help individuals.
And I know Jan's going to probably want to respond to some of what she heard there. Before we do that, though, there was one other part of his phone call that I want to ask you directly about, which is his idea of what we would probably call monitored use clinics, which we do see proposed, discussed. I don't know how widely they've been practiced. I hear Philadelphia. I'm trying to think of other places where they've been sort of floated. Now, there's usually a lot of opposition among law enforcement. Ithaca's had discussion as an example in our area, but there's usually enough opposition that we haven't seen it widely used yet. Would you be in favor of monitored use clinics?
So what I would say to that is that we have a lot of treatment options, both policies and programs at our option, at our disposal, and we really need to tailor the need to the community and get community buy-in. I do not think that we should say no to those. I think the Kensington neighborhood in Philly is working on that right now. I think we need to think about all hands on deck approach here. And it is something, but we do need law enforcement as well as community buy into those things. We just can't go at it alone.
Okay, fair enough. And the reason I wanted to ask Jana about this is, you know, when Keith describes, well, it's a choice, they keep doing it to themselves, you think about, and think about this sort of scientifically, Keith. Early in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, when opioids were sort of in development, and I don't want to misquote, but Dr. Gupta, my understanding is that the early promise was, well, it's going to be 1%, maybe 2% of the population that might be prone to addiction to these opioids, which is actually, what, 10 to 12%, something like that? Is that accurate?
Yeah, and I've been told by pharmaceutical representative in my office that, oh, no, don't worry about addiction. That's not a problem, especially with long-acting drugs. So yes, we were misinformed.
And they knew about it.
Absolutely.
They knew about it. So Keith, I am not, as far as I know, in a category of people who could be really addicted to substance. I mean, I enjoy a glass of wine. I can drink a beer. And I could go 5 days without it. And I don't. That is very fortunate for me and maybe for you. But it's different because my brain chemistry doesn't put me in a position where, one drink becomes something very, very different. I mean, Jana, I think Keith is trying in good faith to understand, but he's saying, I don't get it. You keep doing it to yourself. What do you say to Keith?
Absolutely. And I love using kind of these instances as educational opportunities. You know, our language has so much power, and it could be used for good, and it could be used to continue kind of the stigma, you know, in terms like Dr. Gupta said, like addict, junkie, really hurt our approach to trying to treat and prevent and help the opioid crisis and the addiction crisis. I think in terms of being a choice, you know, I chose to experiment with alcohol, much like my friends did, but I have a different brain chemistry. You know, I didn't choose to nearly lose my life. I didn't choose to, you know, throw away the things I cared about. And also to understand the effects of naloxone. You know, it's not just a reversal. What happens when naloxone is administered is oftentimes the person goes into acute withdrawal and they're in so much pain and they're suffering. And, you know, your desire to avoid that pain, to stop getting sick, is stronger than your desire to breathe. And just understanding that pain, I think, will help folks understand why, when it's not addressed, when it's not treated, when there isn't peer support or services that are offered in the emergency room, why folks run out. You know, and oftentimes they're angry and they may be combative because they're in so much pain. Every cell in their body is screaming. You know, and I know with the crisis, when the opioid epidemic, before it was an epidemic, you know, myself personally, I was going to a doctor that was doing epidural injections in my spine. I brought him an x-ray that showed there was nothing wrong with me. And sometimes I was fine, and other times he hit things that, you know, that really hurt me. And I was getting copious amounts of opiates as a result of this doctor. You know, that my choice wasn't to almost throw away my life. You know, my mind told me once I started to experiment, I wasn't able to stop. I just wasn't able to stop without intervention and support.
Keith, thanks for that phone call. We're going to get Robert on the phone. We'll take Katie when we come back here. We've got a number of phone calls to work through as our listeners respond to what they're hearing as we talk about the opioid epidemic. Our guests include Yana Casper, who you just heard, the co-founder of Rockcovery Fitness. And also with us is Susan Verrett Allen, co-president of the Rochester Museum and Science Center Council. She'll tell us in our second half hour why Dr. Gupta is here. And we'll tell you about how you can get involved with an event tomorrow. Dr. Rahul Gupta is here, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical and Health Officer for the March of Dimes and former Public Health Commissioner for West Virginia. Let's take that only break and we'll be right back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, what would you think if you lived near a hill known as Negro Hill, or a place in your town was called Negro Head Point? Dozens of places in New York State carry these names, and they used to have racial slurs that were even worse, believe it or not. We're talking about the history of racist place names, what it says about us, and whether they should change. That's next hour. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connection. Susan Verrett Allen, an event tomorrow. Remind our listeners why we're here, why you're here, and what's going on tomorrow.
It's because of the Nova Addiction documentary that you can stream online, watch it. It was so informative. It changed my whole view and understanding and the message I felt needed to be heard in the Rochester community. So it's tomorrow at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. You can meet Dr. Gupta at 11 o'clock. The luncheon starts at noon. He'll have his keynote speech, which sounds amazing, and we'll have a panelist and also Narcan training if you so desire. So thank you so much for having us.
Okay, and register, get involved where again?
RSMC.org.
RMSC.
Oh, RMSC, yes, .org. Thank you.
I don't mean to do your job. RMSC.org. Yes. Information there if you want to get involved in the event tomorrow. Back to your phone calls and Katie in Rochester next. Go ahead, Katie.
Hi. So I walk past a Kratom shop on Monroe Ave, but basically every day, and I talk to the guys who run it, and they're both in recovery, and they're affiliated. They're doing research, I think, at the U of R on how Kratom as like an herbal possible solution for people going through withdrawal. I just wondered what your experience is with that approach.
Kratom. I don't know of it. Can you spell
it? Kratom.
Okay. Dr. Gupta?
Yeah. Thanks for asking that question, Katie. People often talk about alternatives, including herbal alternatives. I think one of the things that we've got to be careful about, and as a scientist as well, I try to be always data-driven, is that we have to be focused on therapies and alternatives that actually respond in your brain to the chemical changes that have happened as a result of addiction. So in not to be this lesson, but it's sort of in chemistry, but what happens is your brain, when you're suffering from addiction, has this intense desire to have dopamine. And you do all of those actions because you want that dopamine flow to happen. And at that point, there are some good, relatively strong, effective therapies designed in the medical system that address that. We do not know yet whether Kratom or various varieties of marijuana or others can be legitimate alternatives. I know that there are some FDA warnings about Kratom. And I'm somebody that likes to see more research happen. I like to see more alternatives developed over time based in science. And there's there's this level of like, we got to do this today or yesterday. However, there are lots of these that we do not also know the level of interaction they may have within your body or with other drugs that you might be taking. Ultimately, it's your body. And what I would suggest is make sure that you're well-read and updated on any product that you consume because it is your body.
Does that help, Katie?
Oh, yeah, and there's a Netflix documentary out about it called A Leap of Faith. I have a lot of empathy in my heart for the people who are suffering with this or have lost people to this. I have a 9-year-old, so hopefully we can clean this up before she gets into those older years. But great show. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Katie. I appreciate the phone call. Robert next in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My understanding of this whole issue is different than what the doctor is communicating here. My understanding is that Purdue Pharma kind of created this issue by convincing doctors to ask all their patients to rate their pain on a schedule on a scale of 1 to 10. And if they were anywhere near the top of the scale, they had the answer in OxyContin to try to quell that. I think it's, if you look at the commission structure for the sales reps that were pushing this to doctors and pharmacies and such, they made boatloads of money creating this demand for OxyContin and other opioids. And the other thing is that it seems like the U.S. is the only country with this problem. I don't see that, it doesn't appear that Europe has this problem or South America or Asia. It seems to be a uniquely American problem created by a pharma industry that was kind of went off the rails.
Robert, thank you. Dr. Gupta?
Robert, you absolutely are hitting the nail on the head. This is not, I would completely agree with you. Here's what happened. Somewhere in the 80s, these products were being created in the 70s. Somewhere in the 80s, it was like, let's try to have a system where Americans, everyone who has any condition should feel and aim to feel a pain level of zero. And I will tell you, it was not just the pharmaceutical industry. The United States government bought into it. Veterans groups bought into it. The legitimate mainstream science bought into it. And we then all hospitals got reimbursed or penalized for making sure that if their patients were not completely happy, of which pain was one of the factors. So it's much broader than even that. And as a result, yes, those manufacturers, retailers, distributors, as well as others, made a lot of profit and continue to make a lot of profit today off of this. So it is one of those things that has happened as a tragedy. We have lessons to learn from it. And that information was conveyed. I was, again, a practicing physician in the field dealing with it. And the fact is, you cannot achieve and attain a pain level of zero for everyone in an entire society.
Yeah, can I just ask briefly? Has anybody gone to prison over this? I'm serious. I don't know of anyone. Do you?
No, not yet. We hope
in terms of
does.
Pharma. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people hurting. A lot of people who are hurting. And Robert, thanks for that. Yana, how do you feel about this notion of asking people about pain scales and this idea that some people end up, maybe taking opioids when it's on the edge of whether it would be needed, or as Dr. Gupta says, maybe a prescription that's too long, or maybe it's for not chronic pain but a different kind of injury. This idea that we're always chasing zero pain, I know maybe your own personal experience is one thing, but I know also you also work with the recovery community. How do you feel about this idea that we've been sort of trained as a society to think we should be at zero pain?
No, and I'm not a medical professional,
sure.
So I can't speak kind of to that or from that standpoint. But I think what's also mentioned in Dr. Gupta's documentary is our society just wants instant gratification. We want no pain. We want happiness. Mm-hmm. We want stuff. You know, we want to be all these different things, and we want it now. So really this kind of cultural phenomenon that we need, and we want. And I think we're, as humans, we have to feel pain. Some of us are in pain. Some of us can have depression. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't take medications. Again, it's not my area of expertise, but maybe looking at kind of the human condition,
Sure. And Dr. Gupta, the question of a pain scale is, to me, very dicey anyway, because if you have been fortunate enough to go through most of your life without broken bones, major injuries, et cetera, and you're in the hospital and you ask for a 0 to 10, and your history is one thing. I've talked to women who've given birth without medication. And then the next day they're asked, well, how are you feeling today? Do a 0 to 10. Often the response is, well, until yesterday, this might have been a 7, but now it's a 3.
Yeah.
Our experience changes that. And if we're just going by a subjective moment of 0 to 10 and then deciding whether we're going to get opioids, I'm not sure that's a great idea.
Yeah, and to answer your previous question, someone who got to jail, I think most of the people who have gone to jail actually are physicians, prescribers, which is mm-hmm. a lot of them mostly credibly gone to jail for. But yes, we had four vital signs in the, again, history of medicine. That's blood pressure, heart rate, respiratory rate, pulse rate. I'm sorry, the heart rate, respiratory rate, and the temperature. And we added the subjective fifth and made that into a vital sign. And I think that is a lesson for us, and both in medicine as well as in society, that when we push something too hard, we probably don't end up in a good place.
Yeah, and producer Megan Mack just reminds us of the extensive reporting that we're seeing out of right here in Rochester with the Rochester Drug Cooperative. That story going back just a couple of months. If you missed that, a major pharmaceutical distribution company and two of its former executives are facing criminal charges for their roles in advancing the nation's opioid crisis and potentially profiting from it. The Rochester Drug Cooperative was one of the nation's 10 largest pharmaceutical distributors and was charged with conspiracy to distribute controlled narcotics, including oxycodone and fentanyl, for non-medical reasons. So we'll follow that case, and maybe there'll be more of that. I mean, maybe that's part of it. But before we even get there, the question is, how are we going to change people from going down the road of either needing drugs for medical reasons or seeking them for personal pain and other reasons? Back to your phone calls, and this is John in Rochester next. Go ahead, John.
Hi. I guess it's just a comment. You know, a lot of us are loyal listeners, and, you know, people probably are thinking, I think a man made the statement, geez, why don't they just quit? And I guess I'll just challenge, try giving up coffee, your favorite sweets, or alcohol for 4, 5, 6 weeks, and then you'll start to realize the magnitude of what people are going through when they try to give up something that's far more powerful.
John, thanks for that. I mean, I think that is both a good point, but we also have to keep in mind that if there's something that you love and you want to give it up for a month, that's potentially different than actually having an addiction to something. But John's point, I think, still stands in that it's probably easy just to sit here and say, when you're not addicted to something, well, just stop it. Just choose it. Yes, we want people to have agency. We want people to have choice. That's a big key here, Jan. I mean, Dr. Gupta's point, people aren't choosing to be addicted. They aren't choosing their brain chemistry. But you got to have that sort of that fine line where you acknowledge that, but you also say, the choice I'm going to make is X, Y, Z. There's got to be some level of personal agency while acknowledging it's not my fault that my brain chemistry is the way it is. How do you, with yourself, how do you kind of draw that distinction?
Well, I think kind of to that point of, you know, my addiction brought me to different places in my life. And it's not that I'm kind of poo-pooing or saying I'm not responsible for the things that happened.
Sure.
I am. But I didn't, you know, I have the disease of addiction. And you know, my family were pleading with me and just stop. Why can't you just stop? And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. There's a you know, a neurological change.
People will say that to you, won't they?
Mm-hmm. Oh, they sure will. They sure will.
Doesn't help.
It doesn't. It just continues to kind of stigmatize and continues to put shame. You know, if you're a good person, you would just stop.
So what does help? And I mean from friends and loved ones who care about you.
Love. You know, something so simple, compassion, support, and not giving up on folks. You know, and of course there's frustration. Of course families go, you know, they go through the same process. They just don't have something to numb the pain, and, you know, they're present for it. But not giving up on folks, you know, whether it's tough love or love nonetheless, you know, talking about it and being open.
Dr. Gupta, I mentioned off the top of the hour the story from McDowell County, West Virginia. And I promise there's a reason I'm asking this. I've got an email I'll read in a moment. But tell us a little bit about what was going on in McDowell County, for example.
Yeah, the McDowell County is one of the coal counties in West Virginia. It's really where the life expectancy today is the equivalent of what it would be in Haiti. If you travel 500 miles north, get to Fairfax County in Virginia, it increases by 18 years. So it's really an example of where in the 40s and 50s and 60s, it was a thriving area, well-to-do. And now because of the loss of industry, it's really become this place, desolate place with loss of jobs and income, and people are really in a hopeless situation. We went down there and we continue to engage to both from an economic standpoint, economic development standpoint, but also to address this problem. And I'll tell you back to Yana's point that people, when I try to treat, they will remember every attempt that we have tried to help and reach out. And they would often say, you know, the difference is that when I did have full-blown addiction, the only thing I could think about was my next dose. And once we got on medication-assisted treatment to FDA-approved medication out of three are buprenorphine and obviously methadone, they said, what it feels like is a monster is off my head. Now I can actually understand what the TV I'm watching. I can be with my family. I can enjoy my community. So it's a different focus that happens. We found a lot of those people in McDowell County. We also then were able to see how we can distribute a harm reduction program and actually run a needle exchange program, which is, you know, we help people to say, we're going to meet you halfway where you are. We're going to meet you where you are rather than say, you've got to do this, this, this. Try to really understand what people are going through and then helping them in a meaningful way. And we see when you do that, right after, people start asking for help. They actually start trusting you. Trust and not feeling that you're being judged is a really critical component to getting people who are disenfranchised from the system back into the system and get them the help.
Life expectancy, mm-hmm. 18 years less than a county in Virginia. How far away?
500 miles, Fairfax County.
Yeah, that's just a huge difference. Yes. And here's why I bring that up. Rick emails me to say, Evan, some historical context about McDowell County, West Virginia. The town of Colwood, West Virginia, is located there. Colwood is the town in which Homer Hickam and the Rocket Boys, featured in the movie October Sky, lived. So the economic issue you raise is one that has challenged that community since the Rocket Boys looked for alternative options for their economic futures back in 1957. The mine in Colwood was closed and the town sold, but no economic development to address has happened. And I agree that creates an unfortunate environment for the despair that Dr. Gupta speaks of. It is a complex problem. Rick, thank you for that bit of history, because there's no single easy answer. And before we lose the hour, I want to ask Dr. Gupta to pivot in one small way here. We've appreciated your expertise this hour. And if you don't mind, I want to tell you that I've read some of what you've had to say about a separate health issue, and that's vaccines and measles. And you've been outspoken about that as well. And so you've got the microphone, and I don't think we can probably say it enough. So if you don't mind, can you say a few words about what you've been writing about measles?
Well, thank you very much, Evan. I think that's a really important topic. I think both at March of Dimes that we do focus on moms and babies, it's a critical issue, as well as it's been for me previously as a commissioner. If you see, there's over 1,000 cases now or close to of measles across this country when it was declared nearly eliminated in 2000. And about a quarter of them are right here in New York in Rockland County. And the reason for this is the movement, what I wouldn't want to call it anti-vax movement, but it's a movement that basically from all walks of life, people feel like because they don't see it, they don't believe in it, and they feel like we can go without these vaccinations. I can tell you, I've trained in places where I've held dying babies in my hand. I've treated measles and complications of measles. I've seen all kinds of vaccine-preventable diseases and death and despair that happens from it. So I'm a big fan of wanting to have immunization laws that actually do not have any exemptions but for medical reasons. That's the case in West Virginia. And today, if you see, West Virginia does not have any cases. Many other states do across the country, and part of that reason is because if it's a basic math, if you get more and more of your children vaccinated, these are those vulnerable populations, pregnant women, kids who may have other immune-suppressed diseases like cancer, who cannot get vaccine, they're also protected. So it's part of our societal duty to make sure that we protect ourselves, our family, loved ones, but also others around us.
No more religious exemptions you'd like?
I think it's a difficult decision, but we've been very easy on that part in a lot of ways. I think we've got to be real serious about if we're going to eliminate disease, and it's a costly disease. That's the other side of this. It costs a lot of money to investigate and treat these diseases, and they're only a plane ride away today's economy and today's world. We need to think about if there's a medical legitimate reason for it, we should really allow those. But other than that, whether it's philosophical, whether it's religious, I think we need to take a hard look at that.
There's an event tomorrow that Susan Verrett Allen from the Rochester Museum and Science Center is going to tell you about now. If you want to get involved, what's happening tomorrow?
Tomorrow, luncheon at noon at the Rochester Museum and Science Center Reedman Gallery. After that will be Dr. Gupta will have his keynote speech. After that, we'll have a panel of local decision makers and grassroots folks in town that are helping to make these changes that we're all hearing today. And then we'll have some Narcan training.
Registration at rmsc.org.
Yes.
Yana Cashbar, I'll close the program with you. I still wear my Rockcovery 5K shirt that I got last year.
Yes.
One of the hardest 5K tracks in Rochester, I have to say. One of the hardest closing kicks to a race. And met so many great people that day that you're working with all the time in the recovery community. It's not going to be a perfectly smooth road for everyone. That's not life. That's not realistic. Are you more optimistic than you were 5 years ago now, or are you still, you know, sort of feeling some level of despair about the state of recovery in our community?
Both. Mm. I hate losing friends. I hate seeing family members come and just beg and try to find a way to stop their loved one's addiction. But there's so much hope. You know, from the 5K, you saw all those people that came out in support of recovery, and every day we have new advances. So there's just so much hope out there.
How do they get in touch with you? Someone who needs a community, wants to check out Rockcovery, where are you?
We are located at 1035 Dewey Avenue, right in the heart of Rochester. It's a beautiful old firehouse. That's a sober clubhouse wellness center. They could check us out on Facebook, Rockcovery Fitness, visit the website, rockcoveryfitness.org, or give us a call at 585-484-0234.
Always good to have you, Yana. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Susan Verrett Allen, have a wonderful event tomorrow with RMSC. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Dr. Rahul Gupta, Senior Vice President and Chief Medical and Health Officer for the March of Dimes. Thanks for being in Rochester and sharing your expertise this hour.
Thank you for having me, Evan, and I look forward to tomorrow.
All right, short break, more connections coming up.